It's good to be here on this Sabbath day with everyone, this bright, cheery group we have here in Cincinnati. And hello to all of you out there who are connected by the system we have out there on the webcast here. I have one announcement before I begin the sermon today, and that concerns the Passover and First Day of Unleavened Bread. If you haven't already received it, you will be receiving this information, but you're being asked by the individuals over that are working with the different areas out here to send this out to everyone. But concerning Passover and the First Day of Unleavened Bread, we need to know if people are going to be in the Cincinnati area. It has to do with securing a location and making sure that everything is the right size for the meetings, especially Passover. So if you're coming for both, please specify both. If you're just coming to the First Day of Unleavened Bread, please let us know that as well. And we have to have a good count for especially the adults being at the Passover service because of the size and the proper planning for that. So when that information gets to you, make sure that you get it sent to us ASAP. And again, that's coming to you, so be on the lookout for it to get it back into us as soon as you can. Okay. Rather than going into a part two of what was covered last Sabbath, I didn't want to go any farther as far as what was given in that sermon. There just isn't the need to continue on with that particular subject, but there was some that I had to kind of rush through toward the end and didn't really cover everything to the extent that I wanted to. So until I get right back into the swing of things fully, you just have to put up with me on some of these things. In time here, everything will be back to normal. But again, rather than doing that, I still want to be able to go back and talk about a few of the things mentioned in that particular sermon last week. I don't want to do a part two on it today. There isn't a need for that. So again, last Sabbath, we focused on how God, over the past 6,000 years, has been progressively revealing His purpose and power to resurrect mankind from death. And that's an awesome thing when you go back and think of it in that context and see what was done through time, all the way up to the time of Christ especially, and then the church beginning as it did, and the things said by various ones, just like the Apostle Paul, and talking to the church specifically about a context during the past 2,000 years of those who were focusing on something unique for them. And that is the desire to be a part of, at that time anyway, and their calling to be a part of the 144,000. Now that is complete as far as God's work is concerned. But it still continues on. But that's what their focus was. It was a matter of understanding that Christ was going to return, that there would be a few who would be alive at His return, and they would be changed in the moment in the twinkling of an eye, as it talks about there in Thessalonians. So anyway, we discussed some of those things and led up to a part of the book of Revelation there and talking about some of that. But again, they had a specific focus. We have a specific focus now that is changing compared to what it has been in the past 2,000 years, because we have a unique situation of people living on into the millennium. People that are being called, a lot of people that have been called now at this time, their purpose is to live on into the millennium. It isn't to be a part of the 144,000, those who have been called in the last 5, 10, 15, whatever years. We don't know. We don't know who it is that God has called to have a specific part in the government that's coming and who has a specific part planned, prepared for a new age. And those are matters that are left to God. God knows what is best for us. So we discussed those things, that type of thing, in that sermon. So again, much of the purpose for going through that subject last Sabbath was to help us to get into our mind an understanding of that which God has planned and purposed for a future time because of what we're going to see. We really don't grasp what we're going to see yet. We have it by knowledge, but it's like everything we've ever had as far as the church is concerned. Perhaps the apostasy would be a good example. We knew it was going to happen at some time at the end time. But even when it happened, the church didn't recognize it as the apostasy. Even though we were scattered all over the place, even though the church split up into 600 different organizations and groups, and a third just went totally by the wayside and quit attending, quit doing anything. Another third that went back to what they were called out of. Boggles the mind what we went through. And yet, it couldn't be seen for what it was. So we have gone through a lot of things over many years And so much of that which actually comes to pass isn't as we think it will be, or we really can't grasp it. It's like this matter of experience. You can have knowledge, but until you have the experience, it's kind of like ministers who went through Ambassador College and came out and taught about child rearing. And if they didn't have children, you could tell a difference between those who had children and those who didn't. It came out in how they spoke. It came out in what they said, whether they really understood it. So knowledge is one thing, understanding is another, but until you've experienced it, and we haven't experienced the end time yet. When we do, then we'll be able to look back. We're going to learn a lot as we go through it. But one of the primary focuses is the very thing we discussed last Sabbath about an understanding of being in unity and agreement and holding on to what God has given us as a part of His plan and purpose, that at death there are going to be people who have another period of time, a second life. And I don't think we have esteemed that particular period of time in the manner that we need to in our minds, to understand how awesome that time will be. And so again, that was the purpose of that sermon, to help us to grasp that God has progressively revealed the things He has about a power to resurrect, a power to life, whether it be for the first great resurrection or that which is to a second life. And we want to be in unity and oneness with God. We want to grasp His purpose and why He's doing things in the manner that He is. Because it's an awesome plan. There isn't a better plan. It is the plan of Almighty God that is absolute perfection. And the more we grasp of it, the more we understand that period of time that's coming, the better it is we'll be able to deal with death. And we're going to see a lot of it. We're going to see some amongst ourselves within the body. We're going to experience it. That's just a matter of a process we're going to go through. And that's another matter. You'll have to deal with those things as they come. And so, again, we can understand that in large part if we recognize that someone, well, maybe they're a part of the 144,000. But we don't know in all cases. And if they're not, they're in God. Everyone that's been called to a specific purpose, for some, it might be that 100 years. And they have opportunities ahead of them that will be incredible. Incredible. When you think about individuals who have the kind of knowledge and ability they do, who will be able to live on at that time, they're going to have incredible opportunities. The overwhelming majority of the earth that is resurrected at that time, they're not going to know anything. So again, I don't want to make an entire sermon out of this, but just to touch upon some of those things and to stress the importance of what God is giving to us right now is His desire that we be in unity and oneness with Him, that we embrace that purpose and that plan so that we can grasp as we see the things we see, that there's a greater purpose going to be fulfilled still. When someone's not in the body anymore, they're not there. They're just not there. And we're going to see a lot of that around us, of people we know in the world around us, perhaps some amongst ourselves. So again, I want to mention one other thing before we continue on with the sermon today, and that is, I mentioned toward the end of the sermon how that some may be resurrected back to life at the time of Christ's coming. We don't know. I don't know. And there are a lot of things we really don't grasp or even know, because there's a lot of things that might be involved in that. And what took place when Christ died, that there were some, it says, who were resurrected and came into the city, and they knew them. There are a lot of possibilities there of what that might have been. They weren't people from, I can't even say that. Anyway, so whether that will happen, I just mentioned that in passing, because I also mentioned that at that time, and the reason I mentioned it, at the time that Christ returns, or before He returns, if there are some who are close to us, we can beseech God and ask Him. It's not wrong to do that, that there might be those who would be able to be resurrected. But I'm talking about individuals that this may happen to over the next few years, toward the end of that period of time especially. That's who we're talking about. People who have recently been a part or part of our lives. And it wouldn't be wrong to ask God, but I would caution you that there's a balance in that. just like when Paul talked about healing. When we understand this principle of healing, we beseech God three times, once, twice, three times. You only have to really ask once. If we really grasp and comprehend, God hears us the first time. He knows our desire, but if we want to petition Him again at another time, another point, and perhaps add different things to our prayers, that's fine. But as a whole, Paul gave a good balance and guideline there of three times to petition about a matter. So we can petition about certain things or certain individuals, young or old or whatever. And accept God's will, whatever that is. Because as human beings, so often we want God's will to be ours. I mean, we want Him to do what we ask for. But sometimes in life, we tend to go a little too far with that we expect God to do that. And we don't want to get in a frame of mind ever where we're resentful toward God. And I'll tell you what, sometimes you don't even know you're resentful or you're being judgmental as a human being in God's church until something else brings it to the surface and helps you to see it. And that'll be a time that tests you to the core of your being when those kinds of situations happen. But they do happen, and they will happen. That's just a part of our growth. So we never want to get to a point where we're resentful, judgmental, or unhappy with how God fulfills His will and executes His judgment toward others with whom we have been or are now close to, who die during a period of time before the millennium. Enough said. I do want to say one other thing along those lines. There's much in what I've just covered right now that I'm telling you that we need to think about. Some people use the word meditate. That's the same thing. You think about it. You pray about it. And you ask God to help you to indeed be at one in unity and oneness with Him, harmony with Him, when these events come to pass, because they will come to pass. Today we're going to focus on change that God is bringing about now that was not being offered nor considered for mankind leading up to 2008. Things have changed. That's what some of the book is about. We've been hearing a great deal about that, obviously. And the magnitude of death spoken of last Sabbath that concerns how we need to more deeply embrace God's power, purpose, and timing for a resurrection to life once again has much to do with why God is now working to potentially reduce the magnitude of the levels of destruction that would have occurred after 2008 and up to 2012. I don't know if I said that correctly before, but during that period of time, because that has changed dramatically as to what's going to happen or what has potentially taken place that will potentially allow for many more to have the opportunity to live on in a new age. That's what has changed. That's what God is doing. And it's an awesome thing. So today we're going to, again, focus on some of that change. I'm going to go into some sections on chapter 6 today. So we're jumping ahead. You're going to get a portion of it. I'm going to read some sections of it to help us to be better equipped, again, to receive everything as it comes to us, when it comes to us. After that, we'll probably have a bit of a lull for a time before we go back into the book, as we need to cover some other things just about how we live our lives and how we're living and how we're doing as a church and what has happened and what our condition is. Sometimes, if we're not careful, we may think our condition is perhaps a little bit better than what it really is. In some areas, it's very good. In some areas, it's not as good. And we need to focus on the areas that we need to make sure that we are on top of things, that we're sharp, that we don't allow any kind of spirit ever of lethargy or lukewarmness to enter into our lives. And that's always before us. The example that Christ gave to us over and over again about being watchful, being on guard, we need that. We need that desperately. And sometimes we don't know specifically what it is we need to watch. We'll discuss that later. Not in this sermon. But again, God helps us to keep sharp. God is helping us to keep sharp spiritually. He wants us to be sharp spiritually. He wants us to be focused spiritually in a very sharp manner. And though we've come a long way and we've had a great deal of growth in various things, can be lost just like that. It can go by the wayside so quickly. It can make your head snap, truly. If you're not on top all the time, if you're not focused all the time, if you're not watchful all the time, it can be lost. So this sermon today is entitled, A Greater Potential for Change. A Greater Potential for Change. Because again, how God is going to go through and work with the matter of the thunders, the matter of the trumpets, the matter of the seven last plagues, they have all changed. Every one of those has changed as to how God is going to work with those now in the period that leads up to the return of Jesus Christ. The thunders, we'll talk about that later. The trumpets, very much so. I think especially when you talk about the trumpets, I think of the fifth trumpet. That's not even going to be settled until we're there, until we're deep into it. And then it can change dramatically even as we're going through it. That is the one that has the most potential for the most fluctuation prophetically and still fulfill what it says about the fifth trumpet. Word for word, according to God's purpose and God's plan. But how He does it, the details, which are vast, can change dramatically. And I hope they do. I truly hope they change dramatically for the potential of what He's going to allow this time. Because before, it wasn't going to be allowed. Before, with that particular trumpet, there would have been some massive destruction. There still could be some massive destruction on a very high plane. It's the first of the woes, of the three woes spoken of, and what Europe has a potential to do that they may not do in the same manner now. And it all has to do with how God does this, how God is working with people, how God is going to bring many of these things to pass. And it's awesome. It's truly incredible. So, He is offering far more potential for people to change now, whereas before they were just simply judged and it was going to happen as a matter of a judgment. Hope we understand that now. So we're going to again cover a little of what is covered in chapter 6 of the new book, Prophesy Against the Nations, that has to do directly with some of what it states about mankind being given a greater potential for change so that they can potentially become more fully motivated to actually listen to God and respond to Him as they should. That's what this is all about. To grant them the potential, or to give them, to help motivate them, if you will, to stir up a motivation within them. That's not an easy thing to do with human beings, so that they will actually listen to God. So, I'm going to begin reading here in the book, chapter 6. Beginning in the very beginning of that particular chapter. And I'm going to read various sections, but we're going to pick up on the beginning here. And I'm going to jump around here a little bit. But I'm going to try to do this in a manner that people can tell as I'm speaking when I'm actually commenting on some of what's written, and so they know what I'm actually reading. But the chapter is entitled, If You Will Listen, God Will Listen. It's powerful. It really is. If you will listen, God will listen. And when you understand the purpose of the book, when you understand the title and why God is doing this, that says a great deal. So beginning here. In the beginning of this book, much was said about how mankind has not listened to God over the past 6,000 years. One should be able to readily see why the ways of mankind's selfish choices has produced selfish choices has produced over the centuries as a result of its refusal to listen. There has been great human suffering, unhappiness, poverty, famine, massive sickness, crime, oppression, decadence, inequality, injustice, war, and so much more that is just evil. Enough is enough. That is exactly where mankind now finds itself as God is beginning to intervene and telling this world that indeed, after 6,000 years, This is enough. Is there anything that can begin to motivate mankind to finally listen to God? Now, I'll make a comment on that. Look at the history. Look at what's written throughout the Scriptures. Very rarely has mankind ever been motivated to listen to God. And when they do, it hasn't been an easy time for them as a whole, for what they've had to go through. Rare exception of something that will be covered in chapter 6 as well. But going on, over the past several years now, that is exactly what God has been working toward, which is that people potentially become more willingly motivated to listen to Him so that they can be saved to live on into a new age for mankind. This is a near impossible task, as the entire history of mankind attests to the fact that people will not listen to God. However, God is going to bring about a change in such behavior, one way or the other. Either way, it will be difficult, and there will still be horrible physical tribulation regardless. In this final end time, mankind will now bring much destruction upon itself. And if God did not intervene, mankind would destroy all life off this planet or on this planet. This has been said before, but it bears repeating, because at some point, everyone must come to see this. In addition to what mankind is doing to itself at this end time, God is also going to bring certain catastrophic events upon this world in such a manner as to target those who are resisting Him the most. These are those who are carrying a greater responsibility and or are actively causing so much of the misinformation. And I just want to say there, look at the world. Look at how we receive information. Look at the kind of misinformation that comes out from government is atrocious. From government alone, the lies, the deception, the games, the politics of this world, it truly is sick. And mankind, we see a bit of a backlash in this country today as people are getting a little more, that's a good thing, people are starting to get a little fed up with this as they see things that they don't like. And they understand you're not going to change anything. We do the same thing every 4 years, and what changes? It's just getting worse and worse and worse. People are beginning to be awakened to that reality. These things are not happening as a matter of coincidence, and even in this country. They're a matter of design, in large part, to be allowed or be brought to a certain point in time. And with God's help, you know, we're going into a time where God is going to begin pouring out His power, His giving people, I should say, an ability to see things that they otherwise would be blind to and have been blinded to. Now, to me, that's exciting, because as people begin to be awakened from the way we are as selfish, carnal human beings, that's a good thing. I think of so many that have been called into God's church, and since 1969, being called by God at that time, seen all kinds of people being drawn to God in all kinds of ways. So many different ways in which people are called, and over different periods of time, some quickly and some over a longer period of time, depending on what they're going through and how God is working with them and what they're being molded and fashioned into as time goes along if they continue to yield. So there is so much in this process and how people are drawn to God. But I think of us. Think about yourself or of other stories you've heard, because I marvel at times when I hear people, when they speak of certain fellowship, especially at a feast period, when they've been able to meet people they've never seen before, but it's like they've always known them, but they're excited because they get to hear their story. They get to hear how God worked with them and drew them. It's one thing you never forget in your life, and it's how God opened your mind and the process you went through that is unique to you that no one can take away from you. I know how God called me. I know the process, and I know how He's worked with me ever since that time. And no one can ever take that away, no matter what they do. It's between me and my God. and my High Priest and Savior, Jesus Christ. I know. And each one of us then knows that process, something we're never to forget, and to see and understand how God did those things, because the only way, if one of the major things we need to grasp in the very beginning is that the only way we can grasp and understand God's plan and purpose is if He shows it to you. You can't see it otherwise. That's why it's so important that we grasp the distinction of how we've tried to share this with others and they can't. It's like, there's nothing there. And you think something can be so clear to you. And you think without even having to give a scripture, just simple a little bit of basic knowledge should be able to help them to understand it. Like this thing about the difference between a cross and a pole. You think that's so basic. You could see that. Put your hands above your head. Put them out here. Think about it. Just think about it a little bit. Think about this process and nothing there. You might as well have nobody there. You might as well just kind of be talking to yourself, talking to the wall. Because they will not be able to respond to you unless, well, they may be able to respond in a physical way to some of that on occasion. Very rarely, though. But other things, you go to another thing, and soon you're going to find out whether they're really seeing things because God has to give the ability to see. So how were you called? How were you drawn? It's important to understand. It's important to see. The same thing is going to begin happening, is already happening in part. God is working with millions upon millions of people already, preparing them for things. People aren't just living in this world now as a matter of a process without purpose. There is a purpose now that's being worked out because of a time period we're getting ready to go into, because of things we're getting ready to go into. And slowly but surely, minds are going to begin being opened up to various aspects of maybe just life, not the truth, but maybe about certain things of the truth in life, just like in what we see in politics, that they begin to understand this isn't working. This can't work. It can't work this way. And it's almost like throwing your hands up in the air. Nobody can do anything. Hey, that's a good thing. If people can come to the point where they can begin to grasp and see, this world doesn't have the answers. It just doesn't have it. It can't do it. It can't solve its problems. That's a good thing. Because then that can lead you to what is beautiful and true, and God begins to reveal He's the only one who can show you the right way of life to live. So continuing on reading that paragraph again. In addition to what mankind is doing to itself in this end time, God is also going to bring certain catastrophic events upon the world in such a manner as to target those who are resisting Him the most. These are those who carry a greater responsibility and or are actively causing so much of the misinformation, suffering, corruption, injustice, confusion, and evil that is hurting families, communities, or nations. God will do this in the most merciful manner possible in order to help motivate people to change. Yet, there will be many among those who are being directly affected by such events who will actually believe they are not resisting God but embracing Him. Well, that's easy to grasp. Who is it that isn't going to believe what is true but think that by what they're doing that they are already embracing? Well, world traditional Christianity, they already have their ideas and it's hard to break. Going on in that paragraph. However, it is not God whom they embrace. Instead, it is their false religious beliefs about God that they embrace, as with that of traditional Christianity or other false religious beliefs. Sadly, however, people are not generally motivated into listening to God until everything in which they have put their trust is destroyed and or no longer exists. Only then will people potentially begin to genuinely look for answers and listen. The word potentially is used here because even after God gives people every opportunity to begin to listen to Him, they still have the same free choice as they have always exercised in their life. So the potential for change still lies squarely in their own hands. Yet God has shown that this is the only way people will begin to listen. But even then, many still will not. I want to make sure I don't jump ahead in some areas here. Just a moment. Let's continue on here. I'm going to jump on down in the chapter 6. Jumping ahead a little bit. God is not going to allow the destruction of mankind, but He is going to allow mankind to engage in a nuclear war that will build into a final all-out nuclear confrontation that He reveals will itself result in the death of just over 2.3 billion people. I can't comprehend that. I cannot grasp that. But there's a reason why God has set that as a specific point for intervention. Going on. This is mankind's own doing. This is what mankind does to himself, in other words. This is mankind's own doing, and God is going to allow it. If God did not allow it to this shocking level of destruction, the vast majority of the world would still not listen to Him, even after it were revealed that it clearly was Him who ended that war. Yet indeed, God will end it. Now, that's an awesome thing to understand what God is showing. To understand that it has to come to that level at least. To that level at least. To where people are going to have to address what they would have done to themselves if God did not intervene. That if it had gone unchecked of what was going to follow, of what would follow. And the vast majority of this portion here doesn't happen until God does intervene. And yet there's still much destruction that takes place before this. Because we're talking about an all-out nuclear confrontation that does this. There will be nuclear confrontation that begins before this moment in time. There will be things that take place on this earth that are going to be horrible, hideous, horrifying, if you will, before this event finally takes place. So don't confuse the two and don't think that has to be all that mankind does to himself. This is talking about a specific time and purpose that God is going to allow when this takes place. Going on in the book, in this chapter, even after God does intervene to stop any further destruction from any more nuclear weapons, after a third of mankind has been destroyed by them, there is much more that must happen to begin moving the greater numbers of mankind toward a different spirit, to one that becomes humbled and willing to listen to its Creator. That's hard to grasp. That's hard to grasp that mankind has to go through so much, but pride, personal beliefs, personal religious ideas, they don't change overnight, no matter what you suffer through. And it just boggles the mind to think that mankind can be this way. But it really shouldn't, because I think a good example of thinking about some of that is I think of the children of Israel coming through the Red Sea. They saw it part. They saw Pharaoh and his army destroyed when the water came back together, drowned them all. Didn't take very long. Look what they did. Incredible what the human mind can do. Think about it a little bit later when Moses is up on the mountain 40 days. And what do they start doing? They start making a molten calf out of gold. They willingly gave of what had been given to them, of their possessions, to make a calf that they could worship and say, this is the God who has done these things for us. Astounding. How do you describe something like that? And until we go through all this, there's so much to be learned through this process of why God is doing this, how things are going to come about the way they are, and how this is going to help the millennium to get started. Because mankind has to go through a lot more than just this, a lot more than this, to be humbled and to be able to begin to receive the King of Kings when He returns, even with the power He's going to come in. Finishing off that paragraph, the world has great pride, and it is not easily humbled. Therefore, it strongly resists listening to God. Sad. It's too bad it's that way, but that's what God is dealing with. Think of us. How long are we in God's church and we still find ourselves resisting God? Our human nature resists God. I so hate human nature. I loathe human nature. And I have to be careful. The more I know, the more I see of that, the more I understand that, the more careful I have to be in judgment and how I feel and think about people and life. You have to be careful of those kinds of things. The more you see, the more you grasp. I think of how God is. That's what we have to have. We have to have more of the mind of God to be able to deal with those things in a right way, in a sound way. Otherwise, it would be impossible without God. Going on, another section here, jumping down a little farther. Although I do have all that marked, maybe I was going to read more. Let me see if we're going to read more here or not. I might as well go ahead and read the rest of that, since we're already in it. God is taking control of this world. That's what God's beginning to do. Slowly but surely. No, we don't see that yet. But that's what's taking place out here. There's a process whereby God is already working. He's not just working in the church. For 2,000 years, God has powerfully worked within the church to change, to transform our minds. And He worked with calling different ones into the church. I think of all those who came into the church back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s through the time of Mr. Armstrong and the Philadelphia era. I think of that period of time and all that was accomplished and God working with individuals. He wasn't calling the world. The world wasn't being drawn. The world wasn't listening to Mr. Armstrong. They weren't listening to The World Tomorrow. They weren't listening to The Plain Truth Magazine. They weren't listening. Oh, some of them liked it. Some liked it a lot. But they wouldn't make the change. They wouldn't make the commitment. They didn't really listen to God. And it wasn't their time yet. Because there's a unique point in life where we have to grasp mankind can only go so far. And because by his own personal choice, he can't choose God. By his own personal choice, no one can choose God. That's why I hate the expressions from the Protestant world about, do you know Jesus? Oh, I know Jesus. I've given myself. No, you don't know what you've given yourself to. You know what you're talking about. Until God draws you. Until God opens up your mind to the truth. And then if you, with his Spirit, through the drawing of His Spirit, begin to make commitment to certain things, then that's real. But the other in the world is not real. It's not genuine. But the world doesn't know that. But the world is judged by what they do choose, nevertheless. And that's the difficult part with human beings. We have to be able to come to that point where we acknowledge that of and by ourselves, we will never choose God. Of and by ourselves as human beings, there is no one that has chosen to listen to God, to do as God says. Look at all the Israelites. Not a one of them, except the few with whom God worked with His Spirit to help transform their thinking because He had a purpose for them in a resurrection to be a part of 144,000, to be in His government, that He worked with and molded and fashioned them. That's why the 100 years is so important, because that's their time when they're finally able to see. But our ability to judge between our ways and God's ways is not possible until God begins to give of His Spirit so we can really see His ways. I'm saying a lot there that I know we see those things, but there is so much there, brother. And there is sermon after sermon after sermon in the last few sentences I just gave. If we can grasp and comprehend how the great God works with human beings, how He works with us, and how He has been working in the past 6,000 years, how He plans on working during the millennium, and then the great white throne. It is so awesome. It truly is. It's so awesome, exciting, and inspiring to grasp and comprehend the power of Almighty God and what He's doing and why. Anyway, God is working with the world right now to begin drawing them. God is working with millions. It's not going to just happen after Christ returns that all of a sudden, it's like, okay, here it is. Here's my spirit. Now you can see it. They're being worked with already. Just like so many of us, when God began to draw us into the church, did what you receive happen overnight? When the light really went on, it was like overnight. But do any of you grasp and comprehend that there were things that God was working with you in to bring you to a point in time? I think of people who have often told me that, I think of one example that comes to mind, I'll give that one. When people have made comments how that all of a sudden they in the church they were in, they began to grasp something's not right. It's just, so they went to another church and they found out a certain truth, and finally the Sabbath, they started looking for a church, for churches that met on the Sabbath, because they started seeing certain things. Now they think oftentimes that they saw all this on their own ability. Not if they came into the church, they didn't. There's a process of how God works with us and draws us. And so people, I think of individuals who've jumped around from different groups and they never found it, it just wasn't there. Because for that individual or those individuals, there are certain things that God brought them through to see, to understand, to experience, so that they could know God isn't there. So that when He finally did show where He was, it was like, wow, how incredible this is. I understand why those don't have. So God is working with people in the world in a way that He never has, because it wasn't His purpose in the past 6,000 years. Now it is, because we're getting ready to go into the millennium. And we really can't grasp the magnitude of such power, the magnitude of such work that's taking place already. And we have a part in that as well as time goes on. And this book is going to have a part of that. What we're doing as a church and what we support, what we do, is going to have a part in that, because that's what God uses. And it's exciting. So again, I want to read this again. God is taking control of this world. Mankind's self-rule will end. God is sending His Son to a world that has been humbled and ready to listen. He is going to establish a new government, His government, upon this earth. Whatever it takes to humble this world to a level that it must be in order for that government to become established without any more defiant resistance to the levels that otherwise would exist, it will be done. Any strong resistance to it is simply going to be destroyed. The 6,000-year period of mankind's self-rule, that doesn't mean that, please understand, that doesn't mean that people are convicted of God's way yet. That doesn't mean that people's human nature still isn't going to resist, because it will, but the kind of resistance that leads up to this period of time, or that would be there, isn't going to be there to the same level by any measure, because God is going to humble this world. Massively so. Going back to this paragraph. The 6,000-year period of mankind's self-rule is finally and definitely coming to an end, and God is going to establish His righteous, just, and merciful rule over mankind for the next 1,000 years. It will no longer matter whether anyone likes it or not, whether they agree with it or not. Mankind's self-rule is almost at its end. God's great desire through all this is to create the best means possible whereby the maximum number of people will potentially become humbled and begin to listen to Him rather than be destroyed. Opposition to God and refusal to listen to Him is what has brought mankind to the point of its own self extinction. That kind of strong opposition is finally going to be brought to an end. Then under a section here entitled God's Intervention. What are some of those things that God will be doing to help create the best possible environment that could potentially bring more people to humility, whereby they would begin to more willingly listen to Him? God is working to create just such an environment. God is going to intervene in several different ways and at different times in order to maximize the potential for bringing many more to humility, so that they might then begin to choose to listen to Him. It's a beautiful thing. Doesn't mean they will, but the potential is going to be there. Whether they do or whether they don't, that will be in their hands. But the potential, the ability to do so, is there, or will be there. Going on here, this will all involve much human suffering, since there is no other way such a thing can be accomplished. However, the level of death and destruction has the potential to be reduced mightily if people do respond in a right spirit of humility. Well, at that point, I want to think about this thing of humility, because that's what has to change, this matter of pride and reliance upon religious beliefs, or it's like the economy. It's like the thing with oil and watching this thing that's taking place right now, and the deception that's in the minds of people as you hear them talk about it, as you hear them talk about the stock market or about commodities, and it's about more than I can bear. I still watch it. I sometimes wonder why, but I still do. But it tells you a lot about where the mind of people is at this point compared to what it was even 8 years ago, because it's so much, in this country anyway, it's so much haughtier than it was back then, so much more. And that's not an easy thing to change, to break. And even the trust then in different ideas or religious beliefs and so forth that people have, and on it goes. Whatever it is that people trust in, it's difficult to break that. It's difficult to change that within human beings. It truly is. But that's the very thing that God is working to accomplish. Because only then will people begin to listen. When those things are no longer there, everything they've trusted in, when it's gone, then there's potential. Let's turn over to Isaiah. Some scriptures to go along with this about humility. Because even these verses, thinking about some of these verses and going through some of this, I could not help but think, there are things written here that are more for this period of time than any other time for the world. Truly. This is more where we are than we've ever been. I think of our lives and the time period we get to live in. I mean, get to live in, to me, is awesome. I don't care what we go through in this world, what we go through in this life. This time is the most, to me, the most exciting, most awesome time to be able to be blessed, in essence, to experience, just to experience it. Even if what was beyond this was 100 years. To have this period of time to witness, to experience, and then to use that, to know that, to have that, to carry into another period of time, that's awesome. Even in that, no matter what. Isaiah 57 and verse 10. This is the world. This is especially Manasseh right now. But it's typical of the world. Verse 10. You are wearied in the greatness of your way. Wow. What a statement. What could better describe what's taking place out here? You are wearied in the greatness of your way. You have become so great, but look what you've done with your greatness. And you're wearied in it. You have not said, there is no hope. All you have to do is turn on, whenever the stock market is taking a plunge, taking a dive right now, 500 points. You have not said there is no hope. On the contrary. Okay, maybe not for all of you. If you're about to retirement, this may be a time you want to consider taking some of it out. But if you're in this for the long haul, this is going to be great. Someday this is going to come back, and when it does, it's just going to be so great. Keep your money there. Let us play with it. No, that's not what they say. They don't tell you the whole story. Leave it there. Don't bail out. It's going to come back. They don't know where we are in time. They don't know what's going to take place in the world. And there's coming a point in time. It's just going through some periods of time now to lead up to the one when it's finally God's time that there is an implosion. And it does come crashing down around them. and what they have built up. They're going to change a lot because money does a lot to people. Money does a lot to people. When everything you have worked for all your life, all of a sudden, you see it go out the window. All your hopes and all your dreams financially goes down the tubes. That's a big one. That's a big one. That's one of the biggest for human nature. And it's going to happen. Going on. You have not said there is no hope. You have found life in your hand and what you can do and what you believe others can do and what your country can do or whatever. Therefore, you have not grieved. You have looked to yourself. You believe you're going to be able to. No one can defeat us. No one can bring this down. We're too big for that. The big banks can't fail. I mean, that's preposterous. We'll bail them out. We'll just print some more money. We can do this. I mean, the thinking of human beings today, it's insane. But there's no thought that it won't eventually turn around and succeed. There is no thought that this is going to fail. On the contrary, if there was that thought, there would be panic. If there was thought of that, people would bail. But they hold on because that's what they have invested their life in. That is their life. Verse 11. And of whom have you been afraid or feared that you have lied and have not remembered me nor laid it to your heart? God's not in the picture. God is not remotely in the picture in all this. But He will come into the picture when these things disappear. There will be that potential then for God to come into the picture. Have not I held my peace even of old? And you have not feared me? You know, God's very purpose of not being here, of Christ not being here, of certain evidence of things not being here in this world is all for a purpose. All for a purpose. That His presence isn't better understood or seen, maybe is a better way of saying it. There's a reason why God is held back. I will declare your righteousness and your works, for they will not profit you. So what man does, and that's a sermon in itself. Incredible. Verse 13. When you cry, let your companies deliver you. When you finally get to that point and you begin to cry out, I like the New King James says this too. It says, let your collection of idols deliver you. Because you see, it doesn't always have to be a religious thing. It can be Wall Street. It can be when you wake up in the morning, what do you go see? What did China? What happened in China last night? In that China, they're messing around. And it's because of them that some of these things are happening. And they don't understand. Anyway, when you cry, let your companies, let your commodities, let your stocks, let your whatever it is you're invested in, let that deliver you. You're doing well, just rely on that. But the wind shall carry them all away. Vanity shall take them. But he who puts his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. I think of us. I think of exactly what God is offering this world right now, going to begin offering to it. That put your trust in me. It's like going into a promised land. It's like the Israelites being taken out of Egypt and being taken into a promised land. Put your trust in me and I'll lead you there. I'm going to give you an opportunity to live into a new age. Verse 14. And shall say, cast you up, prepare the way. I've gone through these expressions before and what they mean in Hebrew, and it's just like building a road or building a highway. You go down here and you build a road and you take, like a ditch, you take the dirt out of there and you put it up on the road. And you pack it down and you cast up. It's talking about building a highway, in essence, or building a road, in essence, something to be traveled on. And this is talking about that process. And we see that in roads. We can relate to that and grasp a bit of what it's talking. It's what this is the way. Cast you up. Cast you up. As he's saying here. I need to find that spot. I know how to repeat it, but I sure can't find it now. Just one moment. Yes. What What verse is that? I thought I had it just then. 14. Well, thank you so very much. Somebody told me to use these little sticker things. I haven't gotten in that habit yet. I'm trying to put it down where I left off. And she'll say, yeah, right there in front of me. It's horrible. Cast you up, prepare the way. Take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people. In other words, whatever it is that causes that way to be difficult, to be hard, to not be able to be traveled, take it out of the way. Whatever it is that's in the way, and there's a lot to be taken out of the way in this world. Prepare for His kingdom, prepare for the return of His Son, or the coming of His Son to this earth. For thus says the High and Lofty One who inhabits eternity. Isn't that amazing? The One who inhabits eternity. There is only one who has ever inhabited eternity. Whose name is Holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with Him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit. In other words, this is who it is with whom God can work. He can't work with those who are filled with pride. That's the whole story of us coming into the church. He can't work with us until we've been humbled. That's why sometimes we go through a great deal before we get to that point. And then even through that process, we recognize, we learn the importance of being humbled throughout that process, or being able to learn more about humility. And the more we get rid of pride, the more we're getting rid of self, the more humility that can exist and be there, the more that God can work with us, the more that God can mold and fashion and transform this mind and the way we think. With pride, He can't. Pride resists God. And it's hard to break through those barriers. And yet we live a lifetime of God breaking through various barriers in our mind, in the mind, so that we can be transformed and be brought into oneness and unity with Him in a very powerful way. So I dwell in the high and holy place with Him that's of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble. To make alive, in other words. God can make alive the spirit of the humble. The pride, if there's pride there, there is haughtiness. Can't make it come alive. Because it's the opposite of what God is all about. It's the opposite of the mind of God. It's opposite of the spirit of God. And then the two don't mix. You can't mix the two together. Christ tried to explain those things. He didn't try. He did explain those things, that there are those things you cannot mix. You know. So it says here, spirit of the humble, and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. Verse 16, for I will not contend forever. God has a plan. 6,000 years. I cannot comprehend that. I cannot comprehend watching mankind for 6,000 years do what He's done to Himself. I marvel at that. I marvel at God doing that. I truly do. Because the more I see, the more difficult it becomes to see how we as human beings destroy ourselves, how we hurt ourselves, and how it just gets worse and worse and worse. Society just gets worse and worse, especially now with technology. It's just getting worse so much faster. And people are starting to wake up to some of these things. They're starting to see how it's affecting life, how it's affecting families, how it's affecting people, young people, children as they grow up. All they know is an electronic world and instant messaging and texting and all this stuff. It's a different world, and it's not a good world. It is not a good world, and it's not going to be in the millennium. All those things that we think we have to have, get a life. It's not in the internet. It's not in those things. But it's like people have this world, and if you can't be out here walking around, and everything else is like it's oblivious to them in the world. That's not the way you're to live your life. That's not life. That's something from Satan in a very powerful way to hurt and to destroy the mind. And it's why at this time that God's intervening, and why God did not allow technology to come to this level until the very end. Because if this were to go on much longer, we would be far worse than the days of Noah. Far worse than that period of time. And there would be nothing to save. Our minds would be too far gone as human beings. They would be set. And God doesn't want that for mankind. That isn't God's purpose. And so we're experiencing something to realize this is not the answer. This is not the right way. This is not what is good. Horrible, horrible, horrible. And I'm not even getting started in that, of what's bad about it. People are so blind to it. And even within the church, we've had battles with it in our own lives. And trying to find a balance. It's how it's used. Everything in life is about how something is used. And we're not using well what's available to us in this world as human beings. So God goes on to say here, "For I will not contend forever, neither will I always deliver wrath." Why? Sometimes people read things like this, or they read some of the things that are said here, and they don't grasp what God is like. It's because of what man does that God has to intervene, that there are things that have to happen, that there are laws, and when people break laws, they hurt themselves. And there are these things and that come upon mankind and have come upon mankind at different times. "For the spirit should fail before me in the souls that I have made." If God were just allow it to go on, come to a point where there couldn't be any life any longer. But God's not going to allow that, just as he didn't in the days of Noah. He preserved life. And he's getting ready to preserve it again, this time in a far more massive scale. Verse 17, "For the iniquity of his covetousness was I moved to wrath." In other words, because of our choices as human beings, because of how our minds work as human beings, because we want. We think we're owed certain things. We think certain things are owed to us. You know, amazing how the human mind works and how it works at a very young age. And parents deal with this with children, people grow up and then they have this in their mind and attitude toward their boss or toward a mate or whatever it is in life or toward others around them in life. And what a horrible state of affairs mankind has come to this time. And what is really pathetic and sad about it, people don't believe that. They don't think that. They don't think that way. They think life's pretty good. Life's pretty good. Look at what we have. Anyway, verse 17. "For the iniquity of his covetousness was I moved to wrath and struck him and hid myself and was wrathful. And he went on backsliding in the way of his heart." Just the way of mankind. Been backsliding for the past 6,000 years. Never moving toward God except for those that God has specifically drawn. And that's one of those words is used when it's talking about being called or drawn or this process in the New Testament. It's a Greek word that has to do with drag. You know, sometimes, like, we wouldn't even come forward if it wasn't, "I'm going to drag you a little bit farther here. You're going to see a little bit more here in yourself and whatever." And God does that, mercifully so, because he's bringing us to change, creating something awesome within us if we'll yield to it. But we fight and we resist, and the world backslides. Verse 18 goes on to say, "I have seen his ways and will heal him." I love those verses. Love them. I think of a period in time in the church when we were so unbalanced in physical healing because we didn't grasp this one here. That physical healing is only something to teach us something greater. It's like eating unleavened bread. It teaches us something greater on a spiritual plane of why God gave us to do those things. That goes far above and beyond something just physical. The physical is important, yes, in life. But the spiritual and God's purpose for it is far greater. And so it is here about healing. Healing is God's primary purpose for the human mind. How to heal this mind. To make it whole. Healthy. Because as human beings, anyone that's selfish, filled with haughtiness and pride, is so unhealthy. So far out there, away from what spiritually God intends for it to be. Because it has to experience first the mind of Satan. It has to experience first the mind of the demonic world, a portion of it, of what it's like to live with pride. So you can't judge with God's right way until you have experienced that wrong way, until you know it, until you know it in yourself what it's like to live selfishly and to realize that your human mind and human life is so motivated by selfishness, by every choice and decision you make as a human being. It's about pampering this first and foremost. That's the way we are. We take care of self. Every disagreement, every problem with another human being between two people revolves around that very basic thing, selfishness. That's where it starts. That's where it is. Because what? Somebody wants their own way. Mystery. Anyway, going on. I have seen his ways and will heal him. I will lead him also and restore comforts unto him and to his mourners. See, because there has to be some mourning first. There has to be a period of time when people have this reality check, if you will, and to begin to realize this isn't what it's all about. Or they have to go through such hardship to realize that everything they have trusted in is no longer there. So what do you do now? So God says he's there to give comfort, to show this is the way. Walk you in it. Cast you up. This is the way. Walk you in it. This is the way that will give you this is what will make you happy. I've been in an environment, sitting in classes with individuals who don't have the foggiest idea how to be happy. And I hurt for them. They do not know how to be happy. They talk about marital problems. They talk about problems with children, their own children, and things that have happened in their life. And they don't understand. They don't grasp where happiness comes from. And everything they basically think and do and choose leads in the opposite direction of happiness and fullness and fulfillment in life. Sad, this world. And that's the way of the world. Sometimes we see it in ways that are stronger than others. I've had a big dose of that. No. Has to be changed. Needs to be changed. And people have to be shown the most basic things. You know some of the simplest things in life that are some of the most profound spiritually. It's about give. It's the opposite of get. It's about God's way rather than our way. And we know some of the most basic of things that lead to happiness and fulfillment and fullness in life. And sometimes we don't grasp the treasure we truly have. Sometimes I think of my nearly 50 years in the church. It's approaching that when Christ returns. It'll be there when Christ returns. 50 years in God's church. And I think of, especially when we were larger, how it was so easy for us to remove ourselves from the world. No fellowship in the world. We didn't mix with the world. And so often we didn't really know what was going on in the world around us because it wasn't our environment. It wasn't the environment we were in. It wasn't the environment I was in, especially as a minister and my family and who our friends were and so forth. It was all about, has been, still is, it's about God's church and God's people and God's family. And sometimes if we're not careful, it's easy to not grasp all or the fullness or the depth of what's still out there. And I've had quite an awakening in one sense and realizing just how bad it really is out there, how bad it's become. Thankful God's intervening now. I create the fruit of the lips. Peace, peace to him that's far off and to him that's near, says the Eternal, and I will heal him. I've given a sermon just on that verse alone before. There's so much said there. Can't even begin to go into it right now because you won't hear the rest of the story for today. Anyway. But the wicked are like the troubled sea. In other words, those who don't know God, those who are hell-bent, if you will, on their own way and their own will, because that's what it is. It's death-bent, because that's where it leads. It leads to death. We understand what the expression means. It leads to death. It doesn't lead to happiness. It doesn't lead to fullness. It doesn't lead to blessings of life. What they do works against all those things. It does the opposite. But to the wicked are like the troubled sea. They don't have answers. It's just like, what a way to describe this. A troubled sea, it's just, there's no control. You can't control it. The waves, when they hit, and the destruction, and the things that take place, and that's the life of this world. But the wicked are like the troubled sea, when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, to the wicked. And God is working to change the world so that the world isn't like that anymore. What an awesome thing to understand. The next chapter goes on to say, cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet. It's been God's work. It's been the work of the church for a period of time, but especially toward the end time, beginning through Mr. Armstrong and what God began to do more and more through him. And show my people their transgressions and the house of Jacob their sins. So they have one last great opportunity for that now. That's what we're getting ready to go into, that period of time before Christ returns. Well, going back into chapter 6 here, I want to continue on, but to embrace humility, that's why I haven't fully enjoyed the entire experience by any measure. But this thing of putting on sackcloth and wearing it, I love it. I love it. There's no better state in human life than to be in that state, because it's all about humility. It's the opposite of pride. And it may scratch, it may itch, if you will. Maybe a better way of saying it, you have to scratch it, itches. You understand what I'm saying. It isn't comfortable all the time to wear it. Definitely isn't glamorous to wear it. It's not in style to wear it. But it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing before God. It's a beautiful thing in God's eyes when we are able to wear sackcloth. And we've been brought to that as a church. It's an awesome thing we've gone through and where God has brought us to this point in time so that we can go forward and do something that is unique to us in this end time that no one else has ever been a part of anything like what's about to take place. So, going back here, I'll just read that paragraph again and then continue on from where I left off. But I think I just read that first paragraph. But anyway, again here, I'm going back into chapter 6 under God's intervention, reading that paragraph again. What are some of those things that God will do or will be doing to help create the best possible environment that could potentially bring more people to humility, whereby they would become more willing to listen to Him? God is working to create just such an environment. God is going to intervene in several different ways and at different times in order to maximize the potential for bringing many more to humility so that they might then begin to choose to listen to Him. This will all involve much human suffering, since there is no other way such a thing can be accomplished. However, the level of death and destruction has the potential to be reduced mightily if people do respond in a right spirit of humility. One example that helps reveal the kind of hard-heartedness and stubbornness of human pride concerns what God must do by intervening right away when mankind begins its final course to self-annihilation in an all-out nuclear war. If God were to intervene too soon, mankind would simply dismiss what the true outcome would be if He did not intervene. It's incredible to think about some of these things, to realize how people would respond to these if it didn't happen exactly the way God has it planned and purposed. They would hold to their own pride and belief that they would not go so far as to annihilate themselves. They would not believe the truth of what the actual outcome would become, self-annihilation. So God knows when to intervene. He's written it for us because God knows when to intervene and the best way to work with carnal, physical human beings. The more we learn, the more we grasp that, the more at peace our lives will be and the more in unity we will be with God. Going on in this paragraph. So God knows when to intervene in order to prevent much of mankind from dismissing and ignoring what is true. I will read that again because that has so much to do with the means, the way that God is going to work with the thunders now and the trumpets and especially the seven last plagues in a manner that wouldn't have been done before. That's so different now. And so this statement again. So God knows when to intervene in order to prevent much of mankind from dismissing and ignoring what is true. He's making the potential far greater for them to be able to admit, to be able to see. God has determined, going on in this paragraph, God has determined to intervene at a point after this final all-out nuclear conflict destroys one-third of mankind. Even then, there will still be vast numbers who will not humble themselves and admit what is true. The pride in mankind is exceedingly great. Since God allows mankind to bring destruction upon itself to the extent of 2.3 billion people dying, some would respond by saying, then God isn't merciful, since he wouldn't stop it sooner. You think people aren't going to think that or judge in such a manner? Going on. God does mercifully prevent mankind's self-annihilation. If God did not allow this level of self-destruction to come upon itself, it would not begin to become humbled to any meaningful level. If it would not become humbled, but instead continue to resist and fight against God and the government he is going to establish over all nations, then the result would be that most of mankind would perish. Those who resist God and insist on their own course of engaging in the destruction of the earth will themselves be destroyed. There is no negotiation in God taking control to end mankind's self-rule and in establishing his own government over all nations. The reason God will stop an all-out nuclear war should be obvious, and that is so that mankind does not annihilate itself. However, the manner and means God does so has far greater meaning, and that needs to be understood. Again, it is a question of how the spirit of mankind can be humbled so that it will begin to listen to God and thereby have the potential to be saved alive. God's great desire, above all things, is to extend mercy to mankind. But mercy only has meaning if people are seeking it. If they do listen with a desire to change and live into the millennium, then God will listen. The more who will listen and begin to seek change, the more they can be protected and given continuing life rather than death. Further, God is not only going to intervene to stop that nuclear war, but he is going to intervene in the affairs of mankind in many other ways as well. To me, that's what's awesomely exciting. Going on. Again, this is for the purpose of helping to crush human pride so that people can be brought to humility and begin listening. That which God does will definitely not be welcomed by those who will be most affected by his direct intervention because it will involve much suffering. I want to make sure of how much of this I want to read in some of these portions here. I was thinking here as I was going through some of this, and I was just trying to think about how much time I have here to continue on with this, because I want to get this all done in one sermon as well. I have a lot to read, but this may be a full two-hour sermon. Maybe a little over, I don't know. Maybe it'll be less if I get moving here. But anyway, there is so much, brother. Now, let's turn over to Revelation chapter 8. Revelation chapter 8. We're going to begin getting into an area that should help to make it much clearer how God is increasing the potential for mankind to make real change in their life. That's where we're at in this section of the book. And this is one area that I chose to share with you today out of chapter 6. And I'm not going to go into all of it because there's a lot more to the story. But this will help us to begin to grasp and understand what God is doing and making some changes that will give a far greater potential for people themselves to change. And it's an exciting thing. It's an exciting change. It truly is. It is most awesome. Revelation chapter 8. Revelation chapter 8. I mentioned this a little bit in part of what's been discussed here, but I think it would be good for us to just to go through some of this, talking about some of the trumpets, because a lot of these things are changing. The seven last plagues, they have, the way God is applying them, what he's going to do now is vastly different. Not a little different, it's vastly different from what it would have been on May the 27th, was that the day, 2012? Yes. There are so many dates out there anymore. We have so many dates in our past, it's, I marvel. all with meaning, all with purpose. God minutely, powerfully, systematically, so detailed in everything He does and works out. It's incredible. It's hard to keep up with it all. It's hard to keep it all up here. Revelation chapter 8. Pick up on the trumpets that finally lead into the seven last plagues. Verse 13, "And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by the reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound." In other words, the effect we understand is going to be what is accomplished through what they have sounded. So again, what has led up to this point in time? We're talking about the first four trumpets, and we understand that is so much about this very nation itself and other scattered nations of Israel and what's going to happen to them at the end time here. But even that's changed greatly as to far as to the potential that's there now. But just going into this, verse 13, which are yet sound, verse 9, let's jump on down verse 9 here now, or chapter 9, verse 1, just continuing on. "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven into the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, and the smoke as a smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts unto the earth, and to them was given great power, as the scorpions of the earth have power." Again, God has always given understanding. He gave it to Mr. Armstrong to grasp and comprehend things about the locust and talking about war and machinery, the weapons, the things of war, the armies and so forth. And we've always had a bit of an overview and understanding of some of this no matter what. And that's what it's talking about here, some of the things that are going to take place toward the end. And again, that great being who is behind a lot of this, who is given power to be behind so much of what transpires to go out and do some of what he is positioned to do. Speaking of the locusts, the great army, let's notice verse 9. I'm not going to go through all of this, but again, this one here, above all things, has the greatest potential for a lot of change. It's the most fluid for change because so much of it can continue to have change that's not even recorded in the book because it's not given yet. And some of those things won't be determined as to how the details will be fit in until we're actually there. And there are reasons for that too. There are reasons why God allows these things and does these things in this manner and working with an entire planet of people, billions of people, and what is to be achieved from it all. Verse 9, "And they had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was the sound of chariots and many horses running to battle." So it is talking about things of battle. This is where, after what happens to this country and some other nations and the things that take place that shock and stun and change the world, then this is the course that follows. It is the preparations for war. It is the engagement in war in a greater scale because it already started once what happens here takes place. What happens here will be a big portion of war that's already started. And some of that has changed. Okay. Big portion of war and what God is going to allow to take place. "And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them." And so, again here, there are things that have been a spiritual type of things that have fit for the church. If we can understand, just like the seven ears of God's church, there are things that apply to all eras, out of all seven eras. But one was outstanding for a particular era. In other words, Philadelphia is unique by what was specifically written about them, but everything that could be applied out of the others, there are awesome things to be applied and lessons to be learned and truth to be grasped, understood, and to be lived. And some of those experiences were experienced within those ages and those periods of time, but they were overshadowed by a particular overriding spirit. Hope we understand that. When talking about the different eras. And so much of prophecy is like that. Verse 11, "And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue is Apollyon. One woe is past, and behold, there come two woes hereafter." So I'd like to go into more of this, but I'm not going to now. There's so much here. so much that's fluid, so much that can change. But let's drop on down here. Let's continue on. Verse 13. And the sixth angel sounded. Let's notice. And I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. So again, there are things that they do. There are things that have already been done as far as preparing nations. They're already in preparation. But there are a specific period of time for fulfilling some of those things. They have a specific window of time. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared. It says four. It means at. An hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. They have a work that they're going to fulfill. So that's basically World War III at its height. That's what we're talking about here. That's what's being described here. Because it's already begun. I mean, we get to a certain point of time when we talk about the first few trumpets there. It's already started, but certain nations, just like what happened in World War II, there are people in places that didn't get involved right away. It takes a little bit of time. Preparation for war. Preparation for war. Agreement, a coming together, and a preparation for war. Verse 14. The second woe is past, and behold, the third woe comes quickly. So in this period of time, when we get past whatever is going to be fulfilled here, it leads up to a point where if God didn't intervene, that's where we are in the sixth trumpet here, there comes a point in time when it reaches such a crescendo, such power as being at the point of being released on this earth, that God has to intervene right then and there to stop it. And that's when we come into the last woe. The second woe is past, the third woe comes quickly. And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdom of this world will become the kingdoms of our Lord and of His Christ, and He shall reign forever and ever. Comes to a point in time where an awesome moment in time, a marker in time has taken place. Again, I don't have time to go into all this, but so this seventh trumpet is a fulfillment of the, we understand that, I think. The seventh trumpet is the fulfillment of the seven last plagues. So when that happens, when that takes place, it is the stopping of the annihilation of mankind, but it's the beginning of something else that begins to happen. So we're going to continue on in chapter 6 where we left off and focus more closely on what God is now going to do through these seven plagues, which is far different from before. All for the purpose of providing for a greater potential for people to change and truly begin listening to God. So continuing back in the book here on in that particular chapter, chapter 6. I was going to read a little bit more before this, but I'll just read it all here because of time. It was stated earlier that there is a prophetic day when God will pour out what is described in the book of Revelation as the seven last plagues. So that is the last woe. That is the period of time of the seventh trumpet being fulfilled. Going on. These are what God will use to intervene and stop that nuclear war. It is stated that by these plagues, God will destroy those who are destroying the earth. These plagues have the potential for destroying more than all that will be destroyed in that nuclear war. However, the actual outcome of those plagues is fully dependent upon the response mankind has to them. I hope you grasp what was just said. Yet in all of this, God's great desire, above all else, is to extend mercy so that people can live. However, it is not just so that they can continue to live on in an otherwise sick and polluted world as they have been, but that they might live into a new age of peace, abundance, blessings, prosperity, true justice, equality, happiness, and all of this with great fullness of life. So first, God's purpose in direct intervention through the seven last plagues is to stop the nuclear war, to stop World War III. So this is where God intervenes, and before this, mankind has brought all this upon himself. Now, it's God's turn. It's God's time. Yet there is more, continuing on in this paragraph, yet there is more to how these plagues can now be administered in order to humble far more people and to potentially save many more who can then live on into the millennium. This is one major area God is now changing that has only been made possible by the addition of 7 more years beyond 2012 to Christ's coming. If God had allowed World War III to have begun soon after 2008, His plan to end that war would have been accomplished in one day. Which would have been on Pentecost in 2012. That would have been such a powerful event that mankind would have been stopped in its tracks, shocked to the core of its being. I don't think we grasp what would have taken place when we talk about what had been destroyed in the sixth trumpet and what some of those nations are going to do in an all-out nuclear war, and then when God intervenes to stop it, what He is going to do or would have done at that time on that particular day. It would have stopped, as it says here, mankind in its tracks, shocked to the core of its being, and truly ready to listen to God, as far as mankind is concerned. However, if the world had been humbled in that one day, the death and destruction would have been exceedingly great. God prophetically reveals that the sixth trumpet of Revelation is the time where mankind will engage in a final all-out nuclear confrontation. It has already been stated that this confrontation will destroy one-third of the earth, which means one-third of mankind that will die as a result, or 2.3 billion people. Yet, the next trumpet, which is the seventh trumpet, consists of the 7 last plagues. And this is when God intervenes and stops that war. It states that the purpose of these final great plagues is for Him to destroy those who are destroying the earth. This destruction will come upon those people and nations who are engaged in and supporting that war. That means that there are nations that will support whatever in whatever means, whether it be in Africa, South America, or wherever else in the world that people might think would not be in part of a war. The world is going to be involved in this war. A war going on in this paragraph, a war that is destroying the earth. If this event in the administration of these plagues had occurred in 2012, there would have been an additional 3.5 billion people destroyed in that single day. That's what God's revealed. 3.5 billion, minimal. And likely hundreds of millions more, because that had variation in it again. These events that happened toward the very end of this end time should be feared, just as the flood of Noah's day should have been feared. God will be executing great judgment on this earth against those who have so corrupted their minds that they have become blindly engaged in helping to destroy the earth. But if these plagues could be administered by God in a different manner, whereby many could then have the potential to be saved, But what if, what if these plagues could be administered by God in a different manner, whereby many could then have the potential to be saved? What if the number of dead could potentially be cut in half, or even far more than if these things had occurred in 2012? When asking these questions, it's important to understand that the only way that number can ultimately be reduced in such a large manner is if those who are destroying the earth will begin to listen to God and cease from their evil. That is what God is now preparing to offer to those who would otherwise come under these plagues and be destroyed. As always, the choice is theirs and theirs alone to make. Just because the potential is there doesn't mean people are going to do it. So we don't know the outcome. Under a section entitled here, Purpose of the 7 Last Plagues. As stated, those plagues are going to be poured out first and foremost for the purpose of stopping World War III and to destroying those who are destroying the earth and those prophetic events that are set and cannot be changed. God is now revealing the answer to the following question. How can these plagues be poured out in a different manner that might potentially produce a stronger desire within many people, and even perhaps in some entire nations? That sends chills up down my spine because of what the rest of the book has to say. Let me ask it again here. How can these plagues be poured out in a different manner that might potentially produce a stronger desire within many people, and even perhaps in some entire nations, that they become humbled, begin listening to God, and then cease from the evil they are causing on the earth? By understanding how God has now changed the manner in which He can administer these plagues, once He begins to directly intervene, then one will be able to begin to understand other things that God is doing and changing in order to offer many more people the potential to live into a new age. In other words, to understand how He can work with the thunders and the trumpets. If you understand how He works with us, it says a lot. Continuing in that paragraph, again, as always, the actual results in people's lives is a matter of individual free choice, and therefore fully dependent upon how they respond. Initially, God gave the date of Pentecost 2012 for Christ's coming. That date was not set as absolute, and of being the only time He could send His Son to reign over this earth. Although in the 4 years preceding that date, God's church believed it was the only date for Christ's coming, and they lived their lives accordingly in faith, all the way up to that very day. As a result, the church was harshly mocked because of believing that. Nevertheless, that was the first date that God's church had revealed to them about Christ's coming. Yet God is not confined by time to accomplish many prophetic events unless He has specifically given something that is absolute, where no more time or mercy can be extended. However, there are many areas given within prophetic events where there are exceptions, if mankind will listen and turn to God. For now, however, it's important to know that for the day of Pentecost of 2012, God had revealed that it would be a prophetic day in which He would pour out the seven last plagues. There was a time by mid-2008 that God had set, that there was a time by mid-2008 that God had set for when He would make a final judgment as to when Christ would come, as to whether it would be the first date He'd revealed to His church at Pentecost 2012, or whether it would be 7 years later on Pentecost of 2019. And that's covered later in the book, and you're just going to have to wait for that. Going on, it's important to understand that there is a very great difference in how these final plagues would be poured out depending upon which date God would judge was best for the establishment of His kingdom on earth. If these had been poured out on that final prophetic day in May of 2012, it would have been such a destructive event and would have so shocked and stunned the world that on the following day, the world would have been ready to listen to God. When Jesus Christ does return, the world will have been made ready to listen to God. It's necessary to understand the use of the term for a prophetic day, as this is extremely important in what is about to be covered. This is simply a prophetic expression for a specific time period in which God alone must reveal the actual period it defines. These periods vary according to God's purpose and design, and again, no one can know the actual period of a specific prophetic day that is spoken of unless God reveals it. The seven-day week that God gave to mankind prophetically pictures 7,000 years, where a prophetic day, in this case, is 1,000 years. In this example, the seventh-day Sabbath is equivalent to the 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ, the millennium. The seven-day week that God gave to mankind prophetically pictures 7,000 years, again, where a prophetic day, I think I just read that, yes. You can edit a lot out, Jeremy. Anyway. going on. There are several examples where a prophetic day is equal to 1 year in actual fulfillment. There is also the seventh day that is called the last, or there is also the seventh holy day that is called the last great day. It is a prophetic day that foretells of a 100-year period that follows a millennium, in which a second life is given to most of mankind who have lived and died throughout the span of human life. So again, depending on the purpose, depending on where it applies, God has to give the meaning of that particular period of time, what that is. Any period of time can be represented as a prophetic day, and the actual duration of what God will fulfill in it can only be known after He reveals it. In the case of the seven last plagues, their duration for when God directly intervenes is actually the last prophetic day of mankind's self-rule on earth. Under the section here now, seven last plagues. As mentioned, the prophetic day God had determined for 2012 as being the first possible date for Christ's coming was the literal one-day period that would have been on Pentecost of that year. For all of the reasons being stated in this chapter, God has judged that seven additional years would be granted to mankind before the final stages of the end time should commence, and that Pentecost of 2019 is the day Christ will return to this earth. It will be on that day that He will once again stand upon the Mount of Olives, as Scripture foretells. In making that change, God has also made a change in the duration for which the last prophetic day is to be fulfilled. Instead of that period being defined as a literal one-day period as it was before 2012, God is now defining that prophetic day as 50 actual days. Awesome. Awesome. And there's so much more that goes along with this. Jumping down a little bit farther in the book. This entire process is one of the means whereby God is revealing His desire to extend great mercy to as many people as possible in this final end time. The means of God's intervention and use of these plagues reflects that desire and purpose that He is seeking to work out, whereby a vastly greater number of people can potentially be delivered into the millennium. Though there will still be great suffering and death, that can be reduced mightily throughout this time period if people will only humble themselves before God. God is extending much mercy through this process, as people are being offered a far greater opportunity for being saved alive. If they will not be humbled by this process and begin listening to God, then the last of these days will be very strong against those who are destroying the earth, because mankind will be humbled before Christ returns. This entire process, although very catastrophic in nature, is all designed to heighten the potential for mankind to become humbled and then to become motivated with a desire to listen. People must be brought to the point where they will begin to look at themselves realistically and far more truthfully in order to acknowledge great change must take place in themselves. Yet again, throughout the administration of these plagues, the level of destruction that will be administered rests solely upon how those who are destroying the earth will respond. If they still will not be humbled, they will simply be destroyed. And that total number could still be in excess of 3.5 billion people. This period of the plagues will be mankind's last opportunity to begin to listen to God. God has been very patient and full of mercy. It is mankind that has refused to listen to Him and is instead bent on its own self-destruction. So, again, what an awesome thing to understand that, and I'll just mention here because I'm not going to go through that section of the book right now, but a plague can come out in one particular moment in time, or several of those plagues can come out at a particular moment in time over different parts of the earth. and they can be repeated, and a time can be given and repeated again. If people are bent on destroying the earth, they will continue, and they will be strong, and they will get stronger. And God can control them in any manner He will, and all seven of those plagues can be poured out, in essence, upon mankind, exactly as God deems necessary to fulfill an opportunity, or if you will, to give a greater potential for mankind. So if you can begin to grasp here how that if those all have been poured out in one day, there have been massive destruction, and now to grasp and comprehend what God is striving to give mankind the potential for and why He's given this a period of time, it is to grant the potential there for many people to have the opportunity to be saved, alive, to live into a new age. And to me, that's an awesome thing, because He's also revealing that entire nations can be motivated, moved to change. Go back and read some of those plagues and what they say. And if you understand the power there of what God can do and what God is going to do, and space it out and do them in any way He sees fit, because it will be what God judges, what He does at that time, and God alone. It's an awesome thing, especially if you think of the potential for what is there, for what He's going to do. And basically that's what some of the things concerning the fifth trumpet especially is all about. It's a change of things that can take place, of things that God's going to bring upon this earth and work to move, to motivate people to respond differently. He's going to work with Europe in a different manner. He's going to give people the opportunity, the potential to change, even during that fifth trumpet, during that period of time. And even before that, as far as this country is concerned, but before I close, I just have to say again, from what God has revealed, this country has gotten worse. And there is a period of time that it has. We have a year, I feel very confident, very bold in saying we have a year to accomplish what we're going to do concerning the book and fulfill the things that are still written there about a work that's to be done. But at some point in time, that momentum is going to begin changing drastically on this earth. And all by design by God to give people chance and opportunity. But the ones that appears that what, and these things can change. That's what's unique about all this. Some of these things can change drastically depending on the response of people. But as a whole, this country doesn't appear that it's going to change. It's only gotten worse. And the way things are right now, it'll probably have greater destruction than would have back in 2009 or 2010 when some of these things could have begun. So, but what is unique are the rest of the nations of Israel, because now they're going to be given an opportunity through time to see something, to experience something that's going to be presented and accomplished in a different way that can work to motivate and move them to repent in mass, potentially. So again, I hope this sermon has helped us to grasp a little bit about what God is doing, why God is doing it. And even as I was going through some of this, I mentioned I had chills go up and down my spine, because I see it, because I know it. And God has given that knowing to know what the potential is there for people. And if only they will listen, if people will only begin to change, to think, can you imagine an entire nation of people suddenly changing? That's the potential of what God offers, and not to just one, but to many if they will. That will conclude there today, and have a different sermon next week.